The second hour of Bloomberg Surveillance begins right now, live from New York City this morning. Good morning, good morning. For our audience worldwide, this is Bloomberg Surveillance, your equity market on the S&P 500, positive on the week for a third consecutive week and positive on the session. Equity futures up by a third of 1%. A stacked 60 minutes for you. Coming up on the program, Jim Bianco of Bianco Research on why the 10-year yield could test 5%. We'll speak to iCapital's Anastasia Amoroso with stocks on course for 3 weeks of gains, and Norman Rule of CSIS as Benjamin Netanyahu strikes a defiant tone. We begin with our top story. Treasury yields holding steady with a slew of Fed speak on deck. Jim Bianco of Bianco Research moving to neutral on bonds and writing this: I expect a 10-year yield move to 5 to 550 to produce extreme sentiment and set up a decent bond rally. Jim is with us around a table for the next 60 minutes or so. Jim, good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
You had phrase, I think, of the last 12 months, that disinflation is transitory. Could you just tell us what was behind that call and where we are now?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, the two things can be true at the same time, that in 21, 22, you did have this transitory part of inflation with the supply chains normalizing, and on CPI that produced 9%. Then it came down. But I think once we got rid of that transitory inflation, what we're finding is that we're probably stuck in a 3% inflation world. So we're not going back to where we were pre-pandemic. We are in a higher nominal growth world. We are in a higher inflation world. But again, it's a 3% inflation world, which means elevated interest rates, but nothing like Zimbabwe or anything like that.
Well, let's talk about the elevated level of rates that we should be used to. Nothing like Zimbabwe. Yeah. What should it be like?
Well, I think that what we're looking at with a 450 yield right now is probably pretty close to, I'm talking about on the 10-year yield, you know, something normal. This is about normal-ish. Anything lower than that would probably come about with weakness in the economy. And if the economy was to show more signs of inflation or strength, you could probably see us push back into the five handle again.
We've got to talk about what this means for the bond market more broadly as well. You've got a piece in the FT out this morning. The headline is "The Total Return Strategy in Bonds is Far From Dead." What prompted this particular one?
Bill Gross wrote a piece last week, and he said that total return strategy is dead. And I took issue with it to say that a certain style of total return strategy is dead.
Just explain that.
Yeah, so in the bond market, Bill Gross, PIMCO, they really developed the idea of total return. You buy bonds to get a coupon, a yield, and then you also have price appreciation. The two of them is total return. For the last 40 years, the total return strategy has been driven by lower interest rates and ever higher prices. Well, that era probably ended in 2020. But that doesn't mean that bonds as an investable class or a total return is done. There's a big yield in the bond market now, a 5% yield. You could start off every year saying, I can get a 5% yield, and if you manage around that properly, you could maybe do a little bit better than that or a little bit worse if you don't. But I think there is strategies in the bond market that can still be very profitable.
Jim, it's not even total return that folks have declared are over. There are a lot of strategies out there that, if you're right, if interest rates are settling at a higher level, perhaps seem like they don't work. M&A is a great example of private equity just waiting in the wings for there to be cuts, for rates to go back below to where they are. So what doesn't work? Total return works. What doesn't?
Well, I think any strategy that was reliant upon lower interest rates, you're right, a lot of the levered M&A strategies that were really the foundation of those strategies was near zero interest rates. Those are going to be very difficult. You're going to have to look at your interest cost relative to the business you're buying and the cash flows that it throws off. And that's going to make the hurdle rates for a lot of these purchases or a lot of these acquisitions a lot more difficult. I don't think we're going to be going back to those microscopically low rates that we saw from 2008 to 2020. That was a unique era that even got us to negative interest rates in Europe and Japan. That probably isn't going to be repeated anytime soon.
What happens to the deals that have already been done, that have had a lot of leverage on them, that refinance when rates are low? What happens to them if rates don't go back down?
They struggle. They struggle because the companies won't be able to throw off enough of a cash flow to actually meet those debt service costs. And it's going to be a difficult period for them.
Jim, let's build on that. What's the timeline for you around that? The phrase we hear a lot on this program is survive until 25. When do you start to see that pressure start to build?
I think it probably starts to build sooner rather than later. I think when you look at the economy, I like to say that every time there is a financial crisis or recession, and we had both in 2020, the economy changes, and this one did change. Now, change does not mean worse. Change means different. And the biggest thing that came out of this is you've seen lower personal savings rates. You've seen higher levels of spending. It seems like people, for lack of a better term, they got PTSD after the lockdown, and then we had revenge travel, and that never stopped. We still have it. We still have people spending. We have the government spending, 6% deficit to GDP, and that's going to continue to push this economy forward, and it's going to continue to keep it running hot. Now, that's good. That's going to keep the unemployment rate, which has been below 4% for 27 months, probably down at those levels, but the price of that is going to be elevated inflation.
The credit stress, though, that you mentioned, can we just sit on that for a while longer? Just a couple of beats. How ring-fenced is that going to be? And let's go back 12 months to last spring. Get some regional banks starting to fail. People are thinking it's the end of the cycle, hard landing. It was dealt with. We've moved on from that. How ring-fenced are these pockets of credit stress going to be?
I think that they are going to be. In the regional banks is a good example of that. They really struggled in the face of, A, higher interest rates with the case of Silicon Valley, but then also the realization that came in last year that office real estate is not going to bounce back as much as everybody thought. And that's why the regional banks and a lot of the smaller banks got hit. And it was ring-fenced to the extent that if you look at their stock prices and if you look at the stress that that sector went under, it never really translated to, like, the general economy or GDP or retail sales or anything. So you've seen these pockets keep coming through as we've tried to adjust to this world of higher interest rates.
So to be clear, you don't see any of those pockets necessarily filtering through to the broader economy if there is that stress?
No, I don't at this point. There's an economist, Rudy Dornbusch, who used to work a lot with the Fed, and he had a famous line that expansions don't die of old age, they're usually murdered. And we don't have, now the murder weapon historically has been a spike in oil prices, geopolitical events, or suffocating interest rates. And I don't think 5% is anywhere near suffocating interest rates. We don't have that. And short of that, I think that the general economy will continue to do okay, if not better than okay. Now, I'm always on the lookout, like everybody else is, about that murder weapon that could come. I thought maybe a year ago it might have been the banks, but it turned out not to be the banks.
Well, and you mentioned you have the two big spenders still out there. You have the government and you have everyday consumers. The government doesn't seem like it's going to stop, regardless of who's in the White House. When it comes to the consumer, you mentioned that low savings rate, something around 3%, they're still spending. Is this the forever now? Is that PTSD just enduring from time on out here?
This cycle, the spending, I hear a lot of people talk about that the consumer is going to slow. Well, they'll ebb and flow. But what the consumer will do is they will keep spending this cycle. What I mean by this cycle, we get that murder, we have a recession, then attitudes change again. Maybe they change that the savings rate goes to zero. Maybe it changes the savings rate goes to 5%. But for this whole cycle, I think that that's not going to change.
Elisa's not here and this conversation's getting dark very quickly. Let's just talk a little bit more about benchmarking to extremes. You almost corrected yourself when you talked about inflation. You said it's not Zimbabwe.
Right.
And when the word stagflation comes up, people often come out and say, well, it's not the 1970s. And we heard that from Chairman Powell last Wednesday. Do you think stagflation is as much a laughing matter as maybe as it was to the chairman last week?
Well, you're right about, you know, benchmarking yourself, because a lot of these terms, when you talk about inflation or stagflation, everybody goes to the extreme. If you say that there's going to be inflation, they think hyperinflation or something. And they're not ready to think about the idea of it being, you know, somewhat elevated. As far as stagflation goes, yeah, if the definition of stagflation is elevated inflation in an era of slower growth, yeah, that's very possible. But if you want a definition of stagflation of, you know, 5, 6, 7% inflation with contracting growth, that's an extreme definition that I don't think we need to go to just yet.
It's the weaker growth that I want to get my hands around. Danny's done great at this over the last couple of days, just going through some of the consumer-facing companies that are facing difficulties, others that aren't at all. Then we get the economic data over the last week, and it's actually pretty easy to construct maybe a decent story of how bad things are right now, even though you might make the argument they're not at all. This came from Andrew Holmhurst. I shared this quote a little bit earlier on the program. I think it's worth going over again. Companies are conserving on labor costs by slowing hiring. They're cutting working hours. Small business hiring intentions have dropped, multi-year lows. Individuals are becoming more concerned about finding a new job and are quitting at lower rates. Have you got a counterpoint to any of that?
No, all of that's true. The only counterpoint I would give, let me take the last one, that they're quitting at lower rates. It's still, the quit rate is higher than anything we saw before 2020. And a lot of these numbers that we're looking at, we're saying, yeah, they have slowed from that red hot pace that we had in the middle of 23 when we were almost 5% GDP. But if you compare it to, say, a pre-2020 era, these numbers are I want to say completely different, but they're in a different level than we've saw before. This economy is at a different pace. So yeah, the economy is ebbing, but it was flowing big last year, but I don't necessarily think that this ebb is going to lead to anything more than just a downturn within an economy that continues to grow at least a trend.
Okay, well, let's put a bow on it and get the policy call. So Thorsten Slok, Apollo, no cuts this year. Sokgen, no cuts this year. Lin Xingfieza of Stifel on with us just about 10 minutes ago saying basically no cuts this year. Where are you?
I'm at the same point. And you basically no cuts. I'll give you two reasons for it. One, I do believe the Fed is political. I do believe that they've noticed the schedule that June, July, and September is the middle of a presidential election. They'll move if the data warrants it, meaning that there needs to be a shock in much weaker data. And otherwise, we're looking at November or December. And only if the data does weaken enough, because Paul said, I need confidence and I don't have it. Well, we're waiting for that data to show up.
You've got to drop that in and not move on. We're going to sit on this for a while longer. They are political, politically biased or politically sensitive. There is a difference.
Right. Claudia Sahm, the economist, gave me a great term. She said that they're not partisan, but they are political. Partisan. They don't sit around the FOMC table figuring out which candidate they want elected. They do not do that. Do not consider that. Political, they've noticed the calendar. They've noticed the winds in Washington. They've noticed where their reputation is. And so that's what I mean by political. They've noticed that the July 31st meeting is right in the middle of the Republican and Democrat convention, to give you one example. That's what I mean by political.
Got it. Jim, you're going to stick with us through the next 45 minutes or so. Jim Bianco there of Bianco Research. Equity futures right now on the S&P, positive 0.3%. Let's get you an update on stories elsewhere this morning. Here is your Bloomberg Brief with Shanali Basak. Hey, Shanali.
Hey, John. Sony plans to sell off the historic Paramount Pictures lot in Hollywood if it purchases the company, and that's according to people familiar with the matter. Sony, which already owns a large film and TV production facility, is said to only be interested in Paramount for its IPs, like the Godfather trilogy and the Top Gun films. In a report from the New York Times, Sony also plans to sell Paramount's TV stations and streaming service. And there's a new investigation into the door panel blowout on a Boeing 737 MAX 9 plane in early January. The SEC is scrutinizing the statements made by the company about its safety practices before and after the incident on the Alaska Airlines flight. The investigation is focused on whether comments by the company or its executives misled investors in violation of the Wall Street regulators' rules, according to three people with knowledge of the probe. The SEC reviews don't always lead to enforcement actions, but they can lead to fines for companies or officials. And Pershing Square founder Bill Ackman was criticized for his attacks on diversity and inclusion policies in a closed-door panel discussion at the Milken Conference in Los Angeles. Ackman has previously labeled DEI initiatives as inherently racist and illegal. At least one speaker said his comments reflected a poor understanding of the civil rights movement. In a statement issued afterwards, Ackman said he has written thousands of words about his nuanced views on this important topic, and he asked people to read them fully to understand his perspective. And that's your Bloomberg Brief, John.
Shanali, thank you. More from Shanali in about 30 minutes' time. Up next on the program is bad news, still good news.
As we sit here right now, some of the bad news is good news. At some point in time, that bad news turns to bad news. So I think the Fed will come out, cut rates, and make sure we do, again, elongate this recovery.
We'll continue that conversation in just a moment. Equity futures positive here by 0.3% on the S&P 500. Live from New York this morning. Good morning. Live from New York City, welcome to the program. Anne-Marie down in Washington. We'll catch up with AMH in just a moment. Bramo taking a long weekend. Danny Berger alongside me this morning for the next couple of hours. Equity futures on the S&P 500 positive by 0.3%. Yields higher by, let's call it a single basis point, 4.4610. As yields retreat for a second consecutive week, they climb just a little bit on the session. Under surveillance this morning is bad news, still good news.
as we had that pullback over the last, you know, couple of weeks, that was a time to, you know, maybe put a little bit more money to work into the equity market. But I think going forward, the risks are more balanced, as you mentioned. As we sit here right now, some of the good bad news is good news. At some point in time, that bad news turns to bad news. So I think the Fed will come out, cut rates, and make sure we do, again, elongate this recovery.
So here's the latest this morning. The S&P 500 climbing to its highest level since early April as economic data supports the case for rate cuts. Anastasia Amoroso of iCapital writing this: we find more positives than negatives for the environment right now. So we would be adding to equities exposure if underweight relative to strategic allocations. Anastasia joins us now for more. Anastasia, can we start by talking about the setup going into next week with some big data points on deck, including CPI and retail sales? Can you walk us through that?
Sure. Well, good morning, John. And first of all, I want to comment on this bad news conversation going into next week. I don't actually think we have much in terms of bad news. You know, we had slightly weaker GDP report, but if you look underneath the hood, we actually have a very strong core demand in the economy. When you look at the real-time consumer data, it's actually improving from earlier in the year. And then if you look at the manufacturing surveys, maybe they disappoint a little bit on a one-month basis, but I still look at the inventory levels, and I think they're low enough to start to jumpstart a restocking cycle. So I think the setup going into next week, the CPI report next week, and then NVIDIA the week after, I think the setup is fairly strong from the growth perspective. And, you know, in terms of inflation, you know, we were waiting for the last mile of inflation. Guess what? It's here. It's upon us. We've managed to go from 5.8% CPI a year ago to now hopefully 3.8% or below this year. So that's almost 2 percentage points of improvement. And, you know, if you look at the core PC metric, it's 2.8%. So that's a two handle. So I think we are in that last mile, and that's actually a positive development.
Anastasia, you sound like someone who would be very comfortable being a bull in this equity market right now. We're past 5,200. Can you keep buying?
Yes, I can. And obviously, the risk reward was better when we were closer to 5,000. And that's why we were saying that we should be adding to allocations if you're underweight relative to strategic ones. But still, if I look ahead and if I look at the current multiple, which I think can be sustained as long as this economic environment is sustained, and if I apply that to $278 in S&P 500 earnings for next year, that gets me to an implied price target of 5,400 on the S&P. I think that's the base case scenario. And so I do think stocks are worth being in and worth staying for. And, you know, maybe the upside to 5,400 is not all that great, but that's for the S&P. And I think you can find pockets of opportunity within the market that should be able to outperform.
Anastasia, it's Jim Bianco. I want to ask you about the bond market. We started the year at the 10-year yield at around 3.9%. We got as high as 4.7% a couple of weeks ago, and we're around 4.5% now. Is that uptrend going to continue, do you think, or do you think we're kind of finding a high yield for the year?
Yeah, I think thanks for the question, Jim. And I think for now, we have sufficiently priced in the new reality, which is growth that is remaining pretty robust, which is inflation expectations that have picked up. And of course, the central bank policy, which apparently may not have much in terms of rate cuts this year. So I think, Jim, that move to 4.7, that sufficiently reflected that. And when we look at the implied fair value on a 10-year based on some of the models out there relative to where the 10-year is today, it is trading above some of those fair value models. So I do actually think that that's what gives me more optimism on the equity market, is if the 10-year can pause around these current levels, then that's less drag on valuations for equities.
Do you think that the Fed is going to move this year? And would that change your outlook a lot if they were to move?
Look, I do think the Fed will likely move once, maybe twice this year. And obviously, that has to be later in the year. Look, the Fed, I think, realizes that they solve what they could solve, which is slowing down demand in the interest rate sensitive parts of the economy. What the Fed cannot solve is the supply of labor and the supply of housing. And when you look at inflation today, what's really making it sticky, it's the fact that wages are still rising and the fact that there's a shortage of workers. And I'm in Miami this week, and apparently the unemployment rate in Miami is 1.9%.
Wow.
So talk about a lot of demand and lack of labor. The Fed can't really solve that.
You know, the Fed can't also solve the shortage of housing and the underbuilding that we've had in the economy of housing over the last 10 years. They could slow the demand, and they have done that, but they can't quickly turn on the supply spigot. So I think having this realization is the reason why the Fed will likely cut interest rates, because they've done a lot, and certain parts of the economy, certain pockets are certainly feeling the strain, which is commercial real estate, especially in office. And of course, that relates to the regional banks as well. So I do think, you know, if inflation continues to be somewhere in the 2 to 3% range, as we move through the year, they should cut rates.
Anastasia, you've been constructive for a while. You've had a bias to buy. I remember you called the pullback in April a better entry point. Clearly, based on the last few weeks, you've been right. Could you tell us how independent your market call is from your Fed call?
It's fairly independent, Jonathan. When we wrote the outlook for this year, we did expect rate cuts. But at the same time, we said, what if the Fed doesn't cut interest rates? And the conclusion was, it is still an equity market that's worth staying in and worth being in. And the reason we said that was because of the growth resilience that we were expecting. You know, there's this notion of the U.S. exceptionalism, of the U.S. economic exceptionalism. And it is so true, because this economy is not all that interest rate sensitive. And in fact, when you look at the consumer, what we pay in terms of mortgage has not actually reset higher, because only 5% of mortgages are floating rate. And yet the amount of income that we earn by parking the cash that we had in a money market account is quite significant. It's a significant pickup. So this is why, you know, we thought that the consumer can handle 5% interest rates as they have, supporting the economy. And that's why, even if the Fed doesn't cut rates, the economic backdrop should support equity valuations and equity earnings, of course.
And so far it has. Anastasia, you've been great. It's good to catch up. Anastasia Amoroso there of iCapital on the backdrop for the Federal Reserve and this market as well. It's been a confusing one for a lot of people, Jim. Help us explain it, how we've gone from pricing in 7 cuts to 1 and this equity market has been okay.
I think when we were at 7 cuts in January, we were under the impression that we were solidly going to a soft landing with some whispers about a recession, and that we were solidly on our way on that last mile to 2%. Then over the past 4 months, the data has really surprised to the upside. And it kind of dashed, at least initially, the recession call, then it dashed the soft landing call. And as far as the last mile for inflation, it's been pushed out. And I think that that's what happened. There was an expectation, like I said, we were going to see, if you go back to the Bloomberg consensus data, we were going to see something like a 1% GDP growth year. And now we're at 2.5%. And that's a big difference.
Massive difference. Jim Bianco is going to be sticking with us. Up next on the program, Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu striking a defiant tone following President Biden's pause on weapons shipments. We'll get the latest from former senior U.S. intelligence official Norman Rohl, sitting down with Anne-Marie down in Washington, D.C. If you are just joining us, equities are positive by 1/3 of 1%. We are up on the morning. We are up on the week, heading towards 3 weeks of gains on the S&P 500. Yields are a little bit higher this morning by, let's call it, almost the basis point on a 10-year at 4.46. And in the FX market, a euro doing not much at all, 107.77. To round it out, and crude for you, approaching 80 all over again, 79.87 on WTI, and positive 0.8%. Welcome to the program. Stocks doing okay, up 1/3 of 1% on the S&P 500. In the green across the screen on the NASDAQ as well, up by 0.4. Under Russell, up by 0.4% too. On the S&P, as you might have heard repeatedly through this program so far, headed towards 3 weeks of gains on the S&P. Longest weekly winning streak going back to February. Switch on the board and get to the bond market. 2 weeks of falling yields on a 10-year. Down again this week, up on a session just a little bit by a single basis point, 4.4610. And the 2-year poised to close basically where it closed last Friday, anchored at the front end without much economic data through this week, with the exception of that higher-than-expected jobless claims print just yesterday morning at 8:30 Eastern time. Let's finish on foreign exchange and the challenge posed in the FX market to Japanese authorities from the Japanese yen. 155.72, positive by 0.1%. Danny Berger all over the place over the last 2 weeks.
I just think it's so remarkable to first you have the MOF coming out and saying, hey, we're going to intervene in this thing. They do. intervene. They say it again, we're willing to intervene. And then you have UEDA saying that, okay, perhaps it changes monetary policy. And we are at 155, John.
That's the key point. Does it change monetary policy? And do you actually have to hike to actually get the market to believe it? Because right now, I think they just think he's paying lip service to what's happening.
Oh, yeah.
Will he actually consider moving interest rates higher?
Well, look, I mean, the BOJ is literally part of the government. They are part of the government. He's had conversations with Kishida. You know, we talk about, oh, is the Fed political? I mean, the BOJ has to be political because they are part of a political arm. So in some ways, yes, they could easily hike under the influence of the government.
155.72 on dollar yen. Under surveillance this morning, a slew of Fed speak on deck. We'll hear from Bowman, Logan, Kashgari, Goolsbee, and others over the next few days. Traders looking for hints on the Fed's path forward ahead of the next week CPI print, together with retail sales, PPI, and jobless claims. We've got Jim Bianco with us for the next 30 minutes or so. What hasn't been said that can be said a little bit later from Fed officials?
Nothing. The problem that they're facing right now is the June 12th meeting, the probabilities are like 8% the Fed's going to move. The July 31st meeting, the problem is 30% the Fed's going to move. So the market thinks we're on hold. There's nothing they can say. We'll have to wait for data to see if it surprises in either direction that would get them to move off of their current stance.
You've nailed it. In either direction. This is what interests me. What little data it would take to reintroduce a summer rate cut conversation. How much more data would it take to reintroduce a conversation about the prospect of hikes after Powell tried to bury them last Wednesday in the news conference?
Yeah, I mean, we went on last Wednesday, we went from asking him if he's going to hike rates on Wednesday to Friday, maybe a summer cut because we had a miss in payrolls. CPI next week, if it was to miss or to beat, it could really change the narrative over the next couple of weeks. But right now, we're just kind of in that wait mode. So when Fed officials come out right now, the next meeting, June 12th, is kind of baked in the cake. So we all know that there will be a lot more data before the meeting after that.
CPI next week, together with retail sales. You'll hear from some retailers as well. Walmart and Home Depot just around the corner. TSMC, they posted a 60% jump in April sales on the back of seemingly never-ending demand for AI semiconductors and a rebound in the global smartphone industry, too. It follows a 34% sales increase in March. Happened a stock soar to an all-time high just last month. Danny, this sets us up, I think, for NVIDIA, May 22nd, the last big one to report.
Remember ARM the other day when everyone was like, oh,
punished.
They're
poor?
Yeah, but they were like, oh, ARM is giving a worse forecast. Surely that means at some point the AI demand is going to peter out. Obviously not. I think it was Morgan Stanley. They had something like $300 billion was going to be the CapEx for AI spend by 2030. As we were talking about yesterday, the runway for NVIDIA, it literally looks infinite at this point.
You mentioned Peter Chair of Academy Securities. Peter Chair, this, over the weekend, coming into this week, talked about how 10% was a new 1% for tech names after earnings. What do you make of the outsized moves we've seen at the single name level over the last few weeks?
Oh, it's been extraordinary, especially because what you've seen from a market perspective is they report after the close, and then you get most of the move after the close. My mother was asking me about that. Maybe I should have you explain, how does something move after it closes, you know? But that's what's going to happen with NVIDIA. We're going to wait all day, and traders can start their day at 4 p.m., you know, Eastern at that point.
It's kind of bizarre, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's all we're going to be doing on May 22nd. Everyone's going to start work at 4 p.m. Eastern time in the afternoon. Let's turn to our next... Stocks on the S&P 500 positive here by a third of 1%. We are about 100 minutes away from the opening bell. We're counting you down here on Bloomberg Surveillance. Yields are higher by a single basis point, 4.46.49 on a US 10-year. Under surveillance this morning, President Biden cracking down on Chinese EVs.
The Chinese double down on their what we call non-market practices. It's a kind of predatory pricing practice worldwide that has driven out producers in other economies, leaving the Chinese economy having cornered the market in production. Right now, we're still 85% reliant on Chinese production and supply in solar panels. We've also seen it in batteries. We're seeing it now in EVs.
So here's the latest. President Biden set to unveil new tariffs on China next week, targeting key strategic sectors, including EVs, batteries, and solar panels. The reporter behind the story, Josh Wingrove, joins us now for more. Josh, fantastic story, sir. Enjoyed the read first thing this morning. What are you and the team learning about what we might hear next week?
Well, right now we're just trying to figure out the scope of this. You know, this has been going on for some time. As you know, since 2022, they've been doing this review. And the question has kind of been, you know, how high will they ratchet it up? Will they offset it with declines in other sort of less critical sectors to try to make it a wash. It doesn't look like that's going to be the case. And so what the reporting here is that certain key sectors will see tariffs rise, either from existing levels from the floor, from zero, depending on what they are. Those include electric vehicles, solar cells, batteries, but potentially other things. We don't know the full list. We also don't know the levels that they're going to. On the flip side, the other existing tariffs outside of those key sectors are expected to be pretty much more or less maintained. In other words, no across-the-board offsetting decline of some of those originally Trump tariffs. And so Biden is looking to sort of go tougher on China here while also stopping short of what Trump wants, which is sort of new across-the-board tariff, 60% on all Chinese goods. Democrats think that would stoke inflation and pricing. They're going to steer clear of that, it seems. Instead, looking at these key sectors, of course, autos also has a pretty strong election overlay, as you know, and Biden is trying to win an election that runs through Michigan and a handful of other states, so it's hard to ignore the 2024 angle here as well.
Well, let's get into that angle just a little bit more if we can, Josh. Can you just explain to me, as far as we're aware, Chinese EVs don't exactly have a big market in America right now, so what are they addressing?
They think a wave could be coming if they don't do anything, and it's the same thing on steel and aluminum. Biden has sort of teased this announcement in Pittsburgh a few weeks ago with a call to raise tariffs on steel and aluminum, in some cases from 0 to 25%. It's a fairly big jump, and you know, it's really tiny volumes that we see from China coming into the U.S. from both those metals, but they were expected to rise. They're worried about dumping. The U.S. has expressed concern that China will try to export or dump its way out of sluggish growth and some of the woes it's experiencing right now. And it's the same thing with EVs. There are broader concerns with EVs and connected vehicles as well around data security and what information the U.S. is comfortable handing Chinese companies. You're seeing debates about this in all sorts of sectors related to China. Of course, TikTok being top of mind is one of them. So really on both steel, aluminum, and EVs, this is a case of, you know, heading off what the U.S. expects could be a seismic shift as opposed to addressing a big part of the market today.
Well, Josh, when it comes to EVs specifically, the irony isn't lost on most people that both Europe and China have lobbied similar accusations against the U.S. China even filed something to the WTO basically saying that the subsidies that you require for your EVs are discriminatory. So knowing China's stance already on that, how are they likely to respond?
That's the multi-billion dollar question, I suppose, right now. Some of the analysts overnight from our colleagues in Asia are saying that they aren't sure necessarily that there'll be a response immediately, that China wouldn't want to trigger sort of a full tit-for-tat trade war, at least during an election year. It does seem like some kind of response would be necessary. We've seen the Chinese government, criticizing the Americans for taking this reported step. I'm sure, of course, they're waiting to see the fine print, as we all are. So right now, I think this is the question is how far this will go. Remember, Trump, of course, had a bit of a back and forth tariffs on American agriculture exports that hit sort of his political base. So the potential to get back to that kind of environment, of course, hangs in the air. It's just right now not clear what will happen, and if it did happen, what goods would be targeted? Would they try to target Biden's sort of political backyard, or would they target Trump's, or would they target both? It's really unclear.
Hey, Josh, great reporting, sir, as always. Bloomberg's Josh Wingrove there on the latest from the team. Josh, Jennifer Jacobs, Eric Martin, the president and the administration poised to unveil a sweeping decision on Chinese tariffs as soon as next week. Jim Bianco's with us around a table of Bianco Research. Jim, just some final thoughts. The election, is it still too early to think about some of these themes?
Yeah, I think it is a little bit too early because we still don't really know. We're still so wrapped up in personalities right now with these elections and all of these other issues and brain worms and everything else. And we're not really ready to talk
about executing dogs.
Yeah, exactly. When are we going to get to talking about policy? And when are we going to get to talking about contrasting what my administration means versus their administration? So all we're left with is kind of these generic, well, Republicans do this and Democrats do that. And that, I always feel like, is always kind of in the market anyway.
So David Kostin of Goldman would make the argument, not necessarily trade on policy, but trade on just volatility around the election. Should we get a result where Trump, for example, doesn't accept the results again, and there you get volatility and you should be prepared for that. Should we be prepared for that?
I think so, but that's probably an October or November story. You know, actually, you know, it could actually be a November to December story, yeah, more than anything else. But I don't think you're going to see that kind of volatility come into, you know, till at least the conventions at the earliest.
In many elections, it used to be a difference in degree and not kind. It just feels like there's massive differences now between administrations from one to another. Does it make it difficult to look ahead to 25? This is a conversation we started having on this program in the last week. How do you construct a view on 2025 in the American economy and in American markets without a decent understanding of what policy is going to look like from the White House?
And it's impossible to understand because, you know, certain things get said all the time. For instance, a couple of weeks ago, the Biden administration talked about a 44% capital gains tax, and everybody got all tizzy. But we forgot, none of that happens until Congress passes a law and the president signs it. He's not a monarch. And so we hear these kind of things, and then we got to remember, it's not just the president, it's also Congress and what they're willing to want to do as well.
And they've already tried to do that. I think it was Sinema out of Arizona that prevented that from happening already under a Biden administration.
Yeah, and it just shows you how difficult it is to get any of these proposals through, like Trump wanting to put himself on the Federal Reserve Board.
What did you make of that story? Can we finish there? I've heard from so many different people who have all said the same thing about that journal story. They have yet to hear anyone from Camp Trump say it on the record. What do you make of that story?
You know, I understand his feeling. He's already publicly said he would fire Paul if he became the president. And he's already got that committee headed by Arthur Laffer that is looking at potentially who would be the next Federal Reserve chairman. And Arthur Laffer decided it's probably Arthur Laffer. Exactly. So I know that the expectation is that there will be big changes at the Federal Reserve should Trump come back. But as far as, again, as far as him putting himself on the Federal Reserve Board, you got to rewrite the Congress. You got to rewrite the Federal Reserve Act to do it. You just don't get to just, you know, say, I'm on the board now.
Hey, Jim. You'd be great on the board if we could make it happen. Jim Bianco of Bianco Research. Thank you, Jim. Appreciate it. Coming up in the next hour of Bloomberg Surveillance, taking you towards the weekend with Dan Suzuki of Richard Bernstein. We'll catch up with Oliver Chen of TD Cowen. Looking ahead to some of the big retailers next week, we'll hear from Walmart. We'll hear from the likes of Home Depot. And we'll talk a little luxury with him as well. Neil Dutta on the latest economic data in America. Renmax, very best on CPI and retail sales next week. And Mandeep Singh on some of the earnings from big tech. Equity futures on the S&P 500 positive here by 1/3 of 1%.